So, okay, you get 15 minutes for a small telescope. How many do I get for a 4 kilometer in throne?
Yes, but the 3 kilometers.
Yeah, you're right. It's lasting 4 kilometers.
So it's scaling well. So
the
fun.
Number of sources effective.
So first, refresher. So I'm going to talk about LIGO, the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory. So my first slide is on what the effect of the gravitational wave actually is as a refresher. So if one goes by along the z-axis of the screen, is there a laser pointer actually?
There's a real pointer.
All right. Thank you. Then you, the space, the distance between inertial masses gets squeezed along one axis and stretched along the other, and opposite happens half a period later. And there is a second polarization, which is basically a 45 degree rotated version of the same thing. And so what you really want to do is compare the length of two perpendicular arms, and kind of the canonical instrument to read out such a signal is a Michelson interferometer. Now, of course, your displacement signal scales with the length of your arms. So what you want to do is build a large scale facility, even linearly with your arm length. In the case of LIGO, there are actually two such facilities. There's one up in Hanford, Washington. It houses two interferometers, one with a 4 kilometer arm length and one with a 2 kilometer arm length. There's a pretty image of it. And there is another facility down in Livingston. It only has one interferometer with 4 kilometer arm length. Here's another image. They look similar except for the vegetation around it. All right. So when you build such an interferometer, the first thing you need is a really large vacuum chamber. In fact, the LIGO vacuum chamber is the biggest on the surface of the Earth. Of course, it's dwarfed by everything around it. But the next thing you need to do is you have to make sure all your mirrors are inertial test masses, so they don't get moved around by seismic motions all around it. So in the case of LIGO, there is a series of seismic isolation systems, active and passive, the last of which is a pendular suspension of the optic itself. You can see a very thin wire going around the optic, suspending it on the top of the cage. And so the optic has a resonance of about 0.75 hertz, and it's basically inertial everywhere above that. But that's not enough. You need to keep your optics at the right place, so you need to act on that optic. To do that, we have tiny magnets glued onto the mirror, on the backside of the mirror, and little coils to actuate on them to keep the optics where we want them to be. And finally, this suspension mechanism actually right now is the limiting source of thermal noise, so just thermal vibration of these wires is one of the limiting factors. The optics themselves, they're basically silica, 25 centimeters diameter, 10 centimeters thick. A key factor for us is the mechanical Q, again, because if you have a low Q, you end up being limited by thermal motion of the optic itself. The polishing and the coating, it's state of the art. I don't want to say a lot about it, except for coating, again, we have a requirement that it has a high mechanical Q. Again, otherwise it affects the motion of the surface of the optic. So here's a layout of the optics of a LIGO interferometer. We have the two arm cavities, which are the distances we want to compare to each other. They built the Fabry-Perot cavities with a build-up factor of 140. That basically translates in 140 times improved position readout. The light's combined with a beam splitter,
so that
if there is no signal, you should not get any light out of the dartboard in theory. So energy conservation tells you that every all the light is coming back. In order to not lose that, we have a signal a recycling mirror in place that gives us another factor of 50 in power buildup in the instrument. So in order to estimate the sensitivity you can achieve with an instrument like that, well, your basic meter stick is your wavelength of your light, 1 micron in the case of LIGO. You win by the length of the arm and by the buildup factor B. And then there is the factor that tells you how well you can resolve one fringe. That factor is basically limited by the shot noise you get from the power hitting the beam splitter. If you plug in numbers, your typical numbers, 1 micron, 4 kilometers, 140 here, 10 down to minus 11 per root hertz, which is our phase noise sensitivity, you get to a level of 2.5 times 10 to the minus 23 per root hertz. Well, this corresponds to this point down here. This is actually displacement, so times 4,000. Above that, your shot noise is limited by the light. It rises as F because of the filtering effect of the arm cavities. Below that is a region where we expect to be thermal noise limited. And at very low frequency, it's basically how good your seismic isolation can do. Okay, so much for the theory. Then you lock the instrument for the first time. Well, you're not quite there yet. In fact, there are about 5 orders of magnitude that were missing when we first turned it on in 2001. So, well, what do you do? Well, all you can do is keep figuring out whatever your noise source is, eliminate, fix the corresponding hardware, lock your instrument again, and start over. We actually got pretty good at that over the last 4 years. And so here is one of the latest displacement spectra. The actual data is the black trace. And you can actually hardly see in it. Right on top of it, here it's actually a little above, is the design curve. So we actually are at the level that was promised 10 years ago. As expected, at high frequencies, we're shot noise limited. At very low frequencies, it's actually what I call auxiliary loops here that limits us. What I mean by that is, of course, you have all sorts of angular control loops to keep the optics in place,
as well as
auxiliary length control loops to keep beam splitter and recycling mirrors in place. And they always have some sort of a crosstalk to your actual readout channel. So that's what gives you the limit here. Of course, all these loops are in the end also driven by seismic motion, but the transfer function isn't just your isolation. In the middle region, if you look here, the dashed red curve is the total of all our known sources. So there's a little gap there. The latest on that is that we think that might be a non-linearity in our drive electronics. The kind of the symptom of that is that when we have a lot of seismic motion at low frequency, we see the level there increase a bit. This is actually the violin mode. This is the dominant part of the thermal noise is from the suspension. So the suspension has an eigenfrequency at 343 hertz, and so you get the spike up there that comes from this. All right, so this was what we usually call a typical spectrum. Read the best. So, okay. First of all, we are actually what I want to tell you is that we're actually close to that most of the time. So, first of all 3 interferometers are at the design sensitivity now. This is a spectra of Livingston and Hanford, the 4 kilometer instruments. And kind of our benchmark number to quantify how well we're doing is what we call the binary and spiral range. It's nothing else but the sky averaged distance out to which you can see the in spiral of a binary neutron star with a signal to noise ratio of 8. That's a number we just chose, more or less arbitrary. For that quantity, the best spectrum corresponds to 14.5 megaparsec.
What is that distance for the design?
It's 14.
Low,
it actually doesn't, it's, you know, you really win a lot in the sweet spot. It really doesn't, and you're actually a little below there, so it's kind of a trade-off there. Okay, finally, we started the science run, meaning we're just running continuously since November last year. And as I said, these were the best spectra. This is a more honest histogram of the ranges we achieved. First thing you notice, it's a bimodal structure. This is actually day-night variation. This is kind of the thing I mentioned. We get this breathing at the 80 hertz due to low frequency motion that's anthropogenic in nature. The other thing is there are these two additional humps here. We actually had a commissioning break about 3 weeks ago, and we were able to improve the sensitivity by about 20%. So these are more like the more typical sensitivities now. These histograms were just taken right after that break. Same thing is true for H2. This is the 2 kilometer instrument. The spiral ranges are of course of about a factor of 2 from the arm length. Finally, L1 for it, it's, you know, around 10 megaparsec right now. On average, it has been up to about 12. We are actually planning a commissioning break sometime next month to try to get a little more improvement here. And actually, most importantly, we also want to work in the duty cycle. Finally, this is kind of just to give you an impression of the variation over time. This is a 12-hour span plot. And it's just a range plot that every minute over that time, just to give you an impression. There are some outliers, which some of them are seismic, some of them are, and there's all kinds of things that can happen. That's why you need more than one instrument to cut out such things. Okay, duty cycle. This is kind of a sore point at this point. The worst instrument, the Livingston one, only has 55% duty cycle right now. And what's more is we actually have done better in the past. So this is actually the main reason we scheduled another commissioning breakdown in Livingston, to beef up that number and get that closer to where we want to be. These numbers should ideally be above 90%. You know, when a piece of hardware breaks, it's hard to keep it up there. There's a lot of computer hardware in the system. What that means in terms of triple, double, and single coincidence is shown in that graph. So we may be around 50% of triple coincidence. We have at least one instrument running about 90% of the time. The remaining 10% is mostly dominated by a weekly downtime of 4 hours that we do for commissioning, for upkeeping of stuff that just needs to be done. The last two bins are just the commissioning break, so that's why the numbers are so low there.
Don't feel bad. Gemini telescopes probably have a worse uptime record.
Thank you. All right. So what does the future look like? Well, we're in the middle of this S5 science run now. The goal of it is to acquire 1 year of coincidence data. So it's going to go on for at least another year. There are, as I said, some short commissioning breaks being scheduled to mostly fix duty cycle, but probably also a little bit of range. key point that I want to make is the current instruments can do better. This is not a fundamental limit. This was just a design. That's what we promised. That's not what we can do. What we have to do to get that benefit is, since we're shot noise limited at our sweet spot, we have to increase the circulating power in the instrument. To do that, we think we can go about a factor of 4 in power. That's based on estimates on how much our optics actually absorb and when thermal effects actually get bad. So that would be about a doubling the sensitivity order of magnitude, which of course is 8 times in the event rate of whatever you like to look at. This requires a new laser, which is the easy part. That's just buying it. But it also requires an in-vacuum output mode cleaner. And that has to do with the fact that you need to be able to detect the light you get out at the shot noise limit. And we're already using 4 RF photodiodes that are kind of close to their limit. We think that's actually part of why our duty cycle isn't so good. And so just scaling up to 16 photodiodes in parallel at some point is just no longer practical. So we actually want to, with an output mode cleaner, be able to clean up the light and cut down on the RF signal that has no information on it. There are tentative plans to do this after S5, but this is not fixed. This is still in discussion currently. Finally, at the horizon after 2010, if everything goes on schedule, is the current plan for starting installation of advanced LIGO. And I have one slide on advanced LIGO. The bottom line is that we should get a factor of 10 improvement. That's my second last slide. In sensitivity across the whole band. And also we want to push lower in frequency with better seismic attenuation. And we'll have the ability with a signal recycling mirror at the dark port to get a resonant readout at certain frequencies and actually be a lot better at certain frequencies. What that means for your favorite source you can read out here, so for neutron star and spirals, which is the number I quoted before, that brings you in the order of a couple hundred megaparsec. And I think this factor of 10 step is really the threshold of where you say we might see something, to where if you don't see something, something isn't quite right based on all the estimates we know for known sources. All right, finally, why should you care about LIGO? As was mentioned, no gravitational waves have been seen yet so far. But I try to tell you that I really think the current science run has a significant potential of actually seeing something for the first time. And you don't only have to take my word. If you believe more in market forces, there you go. So the most likely source are neutron star in spirals, as I mentioned. And of course, these are the same objects that are now suspected to be responsible for short GRBs. So it really makes sense to start thinking about combining gravitational wave astronomy with electromagnetic astronomy in all bands. And this has, short of actually just improving the confidence on a first detection, it has significant scientific interest, because as far as I know, gravitational waves are the only way to probe the central engine of your fireball. It also has disadvantages. You don't get a good localization of the event, so you want to have other observations to tell you the context of the whole thing. So we're really at a point where we should start thinking about combining the two fields. And I think that was, with that I come to my final slide. I think that's really just the beginning of a new field now.
we're talking about one. We talk about follow-up. What sort of, in the event of an event, what sort of data are you going to give us, and what would you want us to do with it?
Yes. So the first point I want to make there, unfortunately, that's a highly political question. As you know, the field of gravitational wave astronomy has been going on for more than 40 years so far, only false claims. So there are a lot of people who are nervous about saying we saw something. I also want to say that scientifically, I think that's the wrong attitude. So more specifically, what information are we going to give you? It really depends on the event that we think we saw. And we basically divide up our search into four fields. So there's one group that just looks for a typical signature of in spiraling events. So if you would see something like that, then you could expect something like a time and an amplitude of a most likely of an event. There are other groups that are looking for periodic sources. So if you see a signal like that, then you get, maybe it would be a signal of a known pulsar, where we saw something that we're suspicious of. At that point, might be a follow-up, observation of that pulsar, whether it's a glitch in timing or something like that. So it's hard to say in general, but that's kind of the sort with the direction it would go. Yep. Number two, I don't know what it is.
So, not that there's great evidence that neutrons or mergers cause short bursts, but do you, in fact, I think the going bet from the Brits is that they don't, but do you have any limits from the burst from yesterday?
I don't.
Assuming, right. So the second question is, on what time scale do data get reduced, looked at, and then maybe disseminated to the community?
Yeah. Okay. There's, again, two answers. One is, we've been slow so far. So if you look at the publishing record, typically the results are published, upper limits are published about a year after the science run. There are two aspects to why this is so slow. First of all, it's a new analysis. There is no established way of doing it, so there's a lot of discussion going on. How do we do that best? What's the optimal way? The other part is, again, politics. People are really want to be sure what's being put out on the paper. But nevertheless, there is an effort ongoing.
So we have
analysis code running real time, which means we get event information or at least candidates kind of half an hour after they happened, and that's just the time it takes to move the large chunks of data around. So in principle, if all the political issues and the kind of getting used to how you do things is solved, that's kind of time that you can move forward.
Okay. Well, my question is also about can you explain a little bit the process of template fitting and how do you actually arrive at saying I see a 5 sigma signature of in spiral?
Yeah, I personally am not an expert on that. I haven't actually worked on the in spiral analysis. I'm worked more in this stochastic background analysis. But it's basically a match template filtering. So you get your range of mass ratios, and you have a set of filters. You try to evenly space your filters so you have at least 95% overlap between them. And then it's just a classical match filter approach. And then again, there is some reduction of the data you need to do, probably more than one filter rang at a certain event. You have to then decide, okay, that was probably just one event with a little poor noise. No, maybe it was just nothing because, we had an earthquake somewhere or with a lightning strike or whatever.
So the fitting is done in time or?
I believe it's done in frequency domain, but I'm not quite sure for this particular route. It depends on, you know, again, there are different groups doing it. So
they're both actually.
They're both.
Different groups are doing both approaches.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with you. To make real progress, you'll need electromagnetic counterparts or correlations, and that's a real problem. So remember what happened in GRBs. The progress was made when they were localized and fast, and Suarez can jump in. With time delays between two detectors and perhaps other facilities in the world, what are the prospects for any kind of localization of the arrival directions?
Okay. Any localization information from LIGO is going to come from timing. We have a baseline of 3,000 kilometers, 10 milliseconds. So then it really comes down to the signal-to-noise of your source. If you just have a weak signal, you also don't get precise timing information. And so you really, in a limit of when you barely see it, I don't think we can claim to see any direction.
Well, that's like IPN with two sources, so you can circle, right?
Yep.
Is there any other facility that can provide cross-circle?
Yes, in fact, there are other interferometers worldwide that are coming along. Maybe the most promising one is the Virgo instrument in Italy. It has a 3-kilometer arm length. When they're at their design, they're about the same sensitivity as we should have. And, you know, based off our history, they're getting there. You know, it took us 4 years too to get there. There's still about a factor.
Everything works perfectly.
Yes.
According to design, what is the size of the air box?
Well, if you have a strong signal, it's, you know, I don't know the number on top of my head, but it's the baseline you have, which is, you know, 3,000-5,000 kilometers times the timing information. And remember, this is all low frequency, so maybe tenths of a millisecond at most, and you can work out what that works and becomes in an angle.
Degrees.
It's not much. No one's going to be impressed in this room about our.
2 degrees is a lot better than 360. So.
Well, remember also you might have a 1 in 20% chance of having it in the right direction.
And what about the persistent sources? From their position, you can.
There, of course, there are kind of two searches there. One approach for the persistent sources is pick known pulsars, location of known pulsars, and try to see whether a signal is consistent with that. And then there, you already know where the source is, of course. The other thing is if you try to search in the whole sky, and that analysis right now is actually computationally limited. I honestly don't know how if you would see a signal that we don't know where it comes from, a strong signal in the pulsar, how precisely you could resolve that. I don't know, but.
Yeah, just as a comment, when you contemplate doing combined ENM and gravitational wave observations, it's important to decide in your campaign whether the ENM or the gravitational wave approach or window is your trigger. For example, if you look at gravitational waves from pulsars, obviously you start with the known pulsar and the known coordinates. And then you look at your LIGO data, scratch your head, and do some data analysis and see if there's a signal. Likewise, of course, the gamma ray bursts have plenty of illustration on this. You trigger on the gamma rays, and then you look for the X-rays for a better coordinate, and then everything else follows. So likewise here, for example, you may start off with a Clinian survey in the sky in ENM and look for the promising supernovae as the trigger, and then estimate, going backwards in the light curve, the best estimate for the T0 at which time your neutron star or your black hole is born. And in some sense, that has an advantage of dimensionality, because if you do a blind search, then you have a two-dimensional location over your 4π, giving you resolution of 2 degrees. Whereas if you bring it down, knowing a known position of your supernova, you reduce it essentially to a one-dimensional problem, which is the uncertainty in your T0. So I think that's important to take into account, which one is the trigger, which one is the follow-up.
I sort of follow on that a little bit. Since the first thing that's going to be found is a 2-sigma detection that somehow correlated with some GRB, and everyone's going to argue about a posteriori statistics and correlations, since you're not seeing anything now, it's the opportunity to pre-calculate and agree on all this stuff. And has there been a lot of discussion?
Discussion, I bet. Yeah, I get it.
I was just going to get it.
The biggest hurdle is politics at that point. I think from a purely scientific point of view, you know, we could put our best in how likely it is.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen. Really good. So far. So far.